But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.
Welcome to Citywise, the Wealth Show, the podcast where we sit down with the people shaping the future of wealth management. My name is Sophie Downs, and today's episode is coming to you live from Fairmont Windsor Park, where we're attending our 2025 Wealth Manager Retreat. Joining me today is a guest who knows the markets inside out. Anatole Kaletsky is chief economist at financial services firm Gavcal, having co-founded the business nearly three decades ago. Prior to this, he spent 30 years as a financial journalist and commentator for the FT. So, Anatole, a lot of people would say the global outlook is currently somewhat bleak. We've got tariffs, inflation, government shutdowns. I mean, you co-founded Gavco in 1998. How does the current macro environment compare to that of the last few decades?
So I think the environment is pretty bleak. But of course, if you look at the market performance, it's been fantastic. In fact, in equities, it's been the best 2 years, you know, of the last decade or more. And even bonds seem to be performing fine, rather to my surprise. So there is a paradox there. And that, frankly, makes me feel even more nervous and even bleaker. Now, you say that, you know, I've been following the markets for the last 30 years nearly, or 25 years in Gavcal, and before that for another 30 years when I was a journalist, which actually makes me sound even older than I am. There was an overlap between those. But most of that time, I have actually been relatively bullish. In the last 2 years, and the last 6 or 9 months particularly, I've really changed my position, because I think all the fundamentals are becoming more worrying, especially in the economies that dominate financial performance, the US and also for us here in Britain. And meanwhile, the financial markets are just ignoring these risks. So I think we have moved into a period of maximum risk, and one that applies both to risk assets and also to the supposedly risk-free assets, such as bonds, which are actually an even more exposed to the inflation risk, for instance, which I think is clearly out there.
Mm-hmm. And what's the biggest driver of this inflation? Because obviously that featured quite prominently in your presentation.
What are the main drivers for it? The combination of, in the sort of medium term, fiscal and monetary policies, which have clearly turned at least much less deflationary than they were in the past, and now are clearly turning highly inflationary. Governments borrowing like there's no tomorrow, and then central banks under pressure from governments, or even as a result of their own decision-making, essentially financing that borrowing by printing money. Eventually, that leads to inflation. On top of that, in the last 6 months, you've had the tariffs in America, which clearly are going to be inflationary, whatever Trump says. The shakeout in the labor market, from net immigration to deportations, again in America, but even in Britain, I think labor markets have tightened dramatically following Brexit, and now, you know, a further campaign against immigration. So all those things are also adding to the inflationary tendencies.
So what's the key question investors should be asking themselves when, you know, they're thinking about this, seeing the data coming out, and bearing in mind those anomalies we're talking about?
So I think one question is, is my portfolio protected against inflation? How do I protect against it? Unfortunately, that's a very difficult question to answer, because protecting against downside risk is very easy. You own bonds. If there's a recession, bond yields go down, bond prices go up, and everything's fine. Protecting against inflation is more difficult, but otherwise, how else do you protect yourself against inflation? Do you use gold, commodities, property? equities. I think those all are, you know, important questions. But the second big question, which I've been discussing with clients around the world and I was talking about here, is within an equity or risk on portfolio, what is the appropriate balance between essentially American assets and non-American assets? For the 10 years or 12 years after the global financial crisis, there was only one risk asset worth owning, which was U.S. equities. And their outperformance was beyond anything that, relative to every other market in the world, was beyond anything seen in history. That actually began to reverse about 3 years ago. If you look at the relative performance of U.S. equities to European equities, even U.K. equities for the last 3 years, they've been more or less in line. And in the last year since Trump was elected, ironically, the U.S. market has been the weakest relative to other G7 markets around the world and emerging markets and China. So I think there is a reversal of the American exceptionalism going on beneath the surface of all the noise about Mag7 and AI and all that kind of thing. And I think that's probably from a long, you know, for people who aren't market timers, that is probably the most important asset allocation decision to make, is how rapidly should I reduce my overexposure to American as opposed to non-American equities?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you have all the data facilities yourself.
Yeah.
What indicators would you be watching out for to be able to answer that question?
Well, I think that's quite a tough one. You know, a part of it is actually to look at relative performance because we are in a very momentum-driven world. So I think valuations are important and need to continue to be watched. And the final one that I would look at is the very clear signs of speculative excess that we see in crypto markets, in SPACs, in a number of the other the loss-making AI stocks and so on, a number of the other sort of very, very hot assets of the last 5 years, which have done spectacularly well, completely defying the expectations of, you know, fuddy-duddy old people over 70 like myself. The very fact that they've outperformed so much in the last 5 years has made the retail investment community completely oblivious to the risks that are embedded in them. Now, with these kind of bubbles, and I think this bubble is very like the late 1990s internet bubble, but it's actually on a much bigger scale than that. The valuations aren't quite so high, but the size of the companies involved is way bigger. It's incomparably bigger. You're talking about trillion, multi-trillion dollar companies that have asset valuations, which were previously seen only for kind of tiny, you know, newly created technology stocks. So what we know from these bubble periods is that they can expand for a lot longer and certainly go much higher than anybody expects. It's impossible to predict in advance when the bubble will burst. But once it does burst, it's very important to actually get out early. I think it's reasonable to have some exposure to these bubble assets, but you've got to be willing to pull out when the music stops.
Mm-hmm. And can you say, and I appreciate you don't have a crystal ball here, but can you say with any kind of clarity or confidence what time period we might see that burst?
Well, that's the trouble. I can't say. By definition, you know, as I say, you can't tell. If you could tell, then people would start being worried. But I do have, you know, a little bit, not exactly of a crystal ball, but of a sort of historical view, which I think is relevant, and which is this, that I think either this bubble will burst in the next couple of months, i.e. say by the end of November, or it will probably continue to expand for at least another 6 months or so. And that's because of historical regularity, which I've commented on quite a lot and discussed with clients, which I call the financial hurricane season. There is this period between late August and early November, which happens to coincide exactly with the hurricane season in the Atlantic and the storms that come over even here in Britain, which has contained, if you go back through 100 years of financial history, virtually every major financial crisis or market dislocation has happened during that period between late August and November. So I think if it doesn't happen in the next few months, probably you'll be reasonably safe until March or April again. But, you know, I know that's a bit, it is literally crystal ball gazing in the same way as necromancy is, yes.
But quite a short time frame. But I suppose then the question is, if investors are going to pull out money from the US, where should they put it instead?
Yeah, and the short time frame, yes, I would emphasize, I do think that this can't continue for more than another year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe it will be the next hurricane season of 2026, and maybe it will be driven by the recognition that actually, after a slowdown, the world is in this coordinated boom, and it's a very inflationary boom. And then you have bond yields going up to 5-6%, and that could be the straw that breaks the camel's back. You know, significantly higher interest rates and bond yields instead of the lower interest rates that people are currently expecting. So, where should you put your money? I think there is a case now for index-linked bonds, but they have to be held to maturity. You can't trade in them. I think there is definitely an overwhelming argument for continuing to reduce bond exposure and having more in the direction of real assets, whether they're commodities or gold or property assets. Property is actually very cheap, including even residential property in the UK relative to relative to other assets. But also equities make more sense in a generally higher growth, globally inflationary environment relative to bonds. So I think within equities, you've got to look at value in a way that many investors have successfully ignored for the last 15 years. And I think, therefore, value stocks will perform better than growth stocks over the next five. I know people have been saying this, and they've been apparently wrong for the last few years, but I think this is a period when value stocks will perform better than growth stocks. And I think value markets geographically will perform better than what is has been the ultimate growth market, which is the US and NASDAQ in particular.
Let's talk about the UK. Since we're writing for a UK audience, I know they're going to be very interested in hearing about shifts that are coming up, particularly the UK budget. In your presentation, you mentioned that the UK could have an economic renaissance, but only on the back of big policy U-turns. Which policies in particular were you thinking of here?
When the new government was elected in July last year, I wrote a piece literally the next day for our research clients saying that this change election and this promise of change, and remember that the Labour manifesto had a title, one word on the cover of the Labour manifesto was change. And I said, this is going to change nothing. And I argued then, and sorry to kind of quote myself, but this goes to where we are now, that really there are three changes, that at least one of which, and hopefully preferably all three of which, would have to occur to turn around the UK economy, all of which could occur under new government, but there was no sign of them. One, but now I think some of them at least will happen. One is a change in the relationship with Europe, because obviously what happened in 2016-17, whether you like it or not politically, did do permanent damage to the economy. And there was plenty of scope, and is plenty of scope, to restructure the relationship, the economic relationship with Europe, in a way that doesn't mean re-entering the EU, which is not going to be possible. That's one. Second one is the fiscal rules, which they had adopted, made it literally impossible that the UK economy would improve, at least in my view, and I think that's been borne out over the next few years. And the third one I said, which I think is less likely, although another possibility is, if you're not going to have a relationship, a closer economic relationship with Europe, it was pretty clear even last summer that Trump was likely to win and operate a highly protectionist policy in the US. So you're not going to have much of a closer economic relationship with America. The other big economy out there is China. So I think any of those changes could happen. Mm-hmm. Apart from a fiscal change, none of them even cost any money. But there's no sign of the Labour government being willing to undertake any of them. I think in the next 6 to 9 months, the situation is getting so bad and will get worse, I think, with the budget, that there will be some kind of collision with reality.
If you can indulge me slightly, if you were the Chancellor in November, what would be the key change you'd...
Yeah, well, the key change I would say is that, you know, the problem we have in Britain is it's not that taxes are particularly high relative to GDP as a whole. Of course, they're higher for the last 40 years, but the same is true in every advanced economy because we're spending more on pensions and on health and so on. The problem is that under the Tories in particular, the tax system was shifted, the income tax system was shifted to a much more so-called progressive redistributive one. The Tories cut the standard rate of tax from 25% to 20%. That wiped out a very large part of the tax base. Chancellors, I would say, actually, I'm going to loosen the fiscal rules for the next 2 years. I'm going to borrow more. I'm not going to raise taxes at all this year or next year. I'm not going to cut government spending. But by 28, maybe 29 after the election, I will commit, and we can pass legislation which says the standard rate of tax goes back up by 1% a year, every year, from 2029 onwards, until it gets back to 25%, which is what it was before George Osborne came along. And that would be more than enough, I'm absolutely sure, to convince the bond markets that actually Britain is now moving in a sustainable direction. Whereas, you know, putting an extra tax on stamp duty or on housing or on capital gains is not going to convince anybody, because that's not actually a credible, sustainable source of tax revenue. It's still relying on this fallacy that we can just get taxes from the top 1% or the top 5% to pay for 100% of government spending, which is simply impossible.
Mm-hmm. And we've covered a lot of ground here. But to summarise, could you give one piece of advice you would give to investors, considering all these risks we've discussed? Mm-hmm. What's the one thing they should have in their mind looking forward?
I think right now and for the next year, avoiding big losses is going to be more important than chasing higher returns. And so I think, sure, maintain exposure while the momentum is still going up, but respond the next time there's a dip. And I was wrong about this in April, but the next time there's a sell-off like the one we saw in April, don't use this as an opportunity to buy on dips, but use this as an opportunity to, or as a signal to move to a more cautious type of allocation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, amazing. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for joining me, Anatole.
But today is VE Day. The war is
the newly crowned queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing
landed.
Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929. The Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.